Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. Jazza, have you seen this video where Rishi Sunak, who could still be our next Prime Minister, promises to take money away from deprived urban areas and give it to rich places like Tunbridge Wells?
A point of information, if you will allow it.
Sure.
He technically said that he was doing a hustings in front of like some rich people and said, we inherited a load of rules that meant that we had to give money and transfer money to poor inner city areas. And I've started undoing all of that to make sure that it comes to places here like Tunbridge Wells. So he didn't say that he was going to. He said he'd already been
doing it. Yes, that is true.
Yeah.
But he's still planning on doing it.
Rishi Sunak, I don't have any working class friends. Colour me surprised that he wants to take from the poor and give to the rich.
I mean, he did couch it in terms of Tunbridge Wells was not getting enough funding and it was unfair to them. But it's kind of astonishing that he just said that while someone was pointing a camera at him as well.
That he said that while he's... I feel like... in more normal times, but what is a normal time in 2022? I feel like they, in the past, that would have been obviously he's not really, there's nothing else he can resign from, but he would have pulled out of the race after a gaffe like that. That feels like a gaffe, but actually it doesn't bloody matter because he's talking to such a small part of the electorate. It does, I think, weaken him if he does become the next leader. Like, that's readily made ammunition for the Labour Party once they actually do go head to head into a general election that we assume is going to be 2024. But yeah, it's not a great look.
It's not a great
anyway look. Hello everybody, my name's Jazza, that's Jimmy.
It is.
And we meet whenever we want to talk about politics, social issues and current events.
So
what are we going to be talking about this week?
One of our patrons actually said that there was something a little bit defensive about you saying that we meet whenever we want.
Yes, A. Turner, that's specifically to you.
Eternal
thank you so much for your support. Thank you so much for your support. And yes, I am being defensive.
Well spotted.
Sometimes scheduling is hard, okay? And that is why our Patreon is per episode and not per month.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I don't think you can say fairer than that. Eternal Elf actually asked a wider question about what we think about proportional representation systems.
And you know that that's like catnip to us, so that's going to be our bonus episode. If you want to listen to it, then you're going to have to join the Patreon. But that more information about that is going to come in the begging for money segment.
I thought you were going to come up with a more elegant name for it than that. But
no,
you didn't.
No need. What are we talking about this week, Jimmy?
So, as indicated by our discussion of Rishi Sunak's gaffe, which I think it's fair to call it that, we are going to be discussing the progress of the Tory leadership election. Who's going to win? It's the big question now. How are they going to vote as well? What time are they going to vote?
The absolutely wild proposal that people would have been able to vote by paper ballot in the mail and then change their vote online afterwards. I can't see there being any problems with that whatsoever. But the Conservative Party have chosen to delay the sending out of ballots to people and change slightly the way that they're going to be organising the voting. I assume they're no longer going to let you change your vote after you've voted.
That is one of the things. I mean, if you're going to have a system where people can change their votes, I think it's only right that you provide a running tally of who's got how many votes, you know, as things go on, rather than just
like one of those voting things that you sometimes see on Twitch, like press one to vote for this, press
yeah,
two
that sort of thing. Yeah, exactly. But we're going to be discussing all that fun stuff to begin with. Speaking of things that aren't fun, monkeypox, Jazza. That was a seamless segue. Don't scoff at me.
No, it was quite terrible, but you know what? We'll allow it. It's not one of our worst. Monkeypox. We've just come up out of a once in a century pandemic. and we're entering another once-in-a-century pandemic. No, it's not. So, monkeypox is a cousin of smallpox that is endemic in animals, generally in West Africa, and sometimes jumps from animals to humans who have close contact. It is now spreading amongst populations around the world, with clusters specifically around, and the fastest spreading around men who have sex with men in major urban areas. Places like London, for example. Oh, am I a homosexual in London? Oh, am I terrified? Yeah, maybe a little bit. The rollout of the vaccine, I mean, this, I think we're mainly going to have this as a just a little bit of a chance for me to share the anecdotes of my journey to try and get a fucking monkeypox vaccine and how next to impossible it is.
Okay, so look forward to 10 minutes of that later in the show.
Yeah, exactly. I will try very, very hard not to go into my squeaky voice too much.
Okay, and speaking of potential disasters...
You can... Just saying speaking of in front of a phrase does not make it an effective segue, Jimmy.
I think it does, actually.
Okay.
I think it does. So Jezza is also going to be touching on... one of his favourite subjects we haven't looked at for a while, Taiwan.
Yeah, potential war. Oh, sorry, Taiwan.
Yeah. So yeah, we've had the we've had the pandemic, had a kind of plague, had an economic crisis which is rushing towards us as the Bank of England predicts inflation is going to go even higher. And now we could
have covered that in this week's episode, but neither of us are really economists, so it's probably
there's not an awful lot to say other than like people are going to be even poorer. And even more deprived, and that is bad. So
wow.
I think we have covered that off, actually.
Yeah, I mean, knocked that out of the park.
Yeah. So Nancy Pelosi, who is the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, or is she in the Senate?
Correct. No, she's Speaker of the House. She's basically, if it were the same as the UK system, she's essentially the Prime Minister. She's the majority leader of the Democrats in the House of Representatives. She is second in line to the presidency. So if both Kamala Harris and Joe Biden pop their clogs, she becomes president.
Yeah, so she's kind of like a French prime minister then, where she organises the legislative stuff and then the president is the president. But she visited Taiwan, and this is really annoyed the Chinese. They're not happy about it whatsoever. And they've been sailing their ships around Taiwan, sending bullshit messages to the Americans. Then, you know, the newspaper propagandists have been shaking their fists in the air. It does seem quite dangerous, doesn't it, Jezza?
Yeah, we'll talk about it. For anybody who doesn't know, I used to live in Taiwan and I have a lot of friends in Taiwan, and I'm just very nervous about my old home turning into a flashpoint for international relations and producing a potential field site for a Cold War between China and America. Could be fun. I'll try not to cry.
Okay.
Right.
Okay, so now we're going to... do the begging for money section.
It's the beg for money segment. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. And then we'll get into the main podcast.
Love that for us.
As you'll have just heard, we have a Patreon account that I need to start promoting. If you're enjoying what we do, you can sign up, pledge as little as $1 an episode, and you'll get access to an extra bonus segment every time we upload a normal episode. Recent topics have included Jennifer Lopez's surname, Elon Musk trying to bail out of his Twitter purchase, and Eurovision. Patrons can also message us ideas for topics, and we'll take them slightly more seriously than the stuff you send us on Twitter. At this point, I would like to thank our existing patrons, Eterna Elf, Alexander Wood, Andrew Kilpatrick, David Preston, Gemma Cumming, Gia Carney, Ilona Diomkina, John O, Marlene, Matt, Michael Costa, Nick Webb, Seb Kales, and Theo. Seems like a very bad thing that one of our two major parties is doing the voting for its leadership contest online, when anyone who knows anything about computers knows that that's not a secure way of handling an election.
In order to prepare for this segment, I went back and watched the Tom Scott video about why voting online is a terrible idea.
Yeah.
And the main reasoning is, on your suggestion, by the way, I won't take credit for full autonomy there. And like the major takeaway there is lack of anonymity and lack of trust.
Yeah.
So it makes it more difficult for you to be able to truly vote anonymously, because there is going to be some kind of a paper trail in a digital voting world that is a metaphorical paper trail rather than a real paper trail. And also because of the possibilities of results being tampered with, being more easily scaled in a digital space than with pen and paper, or pencil and paper actually is how we vote in the UK anyway.
Yeah.
You end up undermining trust in the system, and so it makes it easier for people to say that, for example, there's been voter fraud, which, to be fair, hasn't stopped the Conservatives from suggesting that anyway. Not quite on the same scale in general elections, not quite at the same scale as American Republicans, but it has happened, and that's
why this was the proposal to introduce ID for voting, which
correct.
Is that
yes.
Is that still going ahead? I know we talked about that ages
ago. Did it not go through?
I guess it might have done.
Look
know.
At us, as truthful as resources permit, listener.
Well, we haven't said anything untrue. We just don't know. But yeah,
ignorance.
All of the strengths of the paper voting system, which is decentralized and, you know, verified by lots of different people, most of whom, you know, are active in politics in some way. I mean, if you're willing to go and sit in a voting station for, you know, the whole day, basically, the chances are you're going to be very interested in politics. It's a much better way of doing things. And I guess that, you know, it's not practical for political parties to have in-person voting in that way, so it has to be online, or it has to be a postal vote of some sort, and the Tories are pretty rude about postal voting as well. But essentially, you can never eliminate the possibility with an online election that somebody has broken into your system and altered the vote. And even the possibility of that undermines trust in the system.
Or even broken into the system and decided to download and play Doom on the system, which is what happened at a hackers convention once with an American voting system. They managed to hack into the voting machines and run Doom on it and play the video game Doom on the hardware. So
yeah,
because
I mean, American elections, some states use electronic voting systems, but you still go into a booth and then you have to press a button.
Correct. Yeah, which seems really stupid to be, because it feels like the worst of both worlds.
Yeah, I mean, you have the lack of convenience.
It doesn't increase accessibility, and it can be tampered with.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously not that scalable to tamper with in-person electronic voting, because you'd have to get access to all the machines. So it is more secure. But yeah, I mean, so initially, as you were saying in the intro, the Tories were allowing their members to vote by postal ballot, and then if they changed their minds because they were persuaded by one of these amazing speeches that Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss are giving, they could then log in using their membership number and they could change their vote. And after consulting with GCHQ, they have eliminated the option of changing your vote once you've used either of those methods, but you can still vote online, so that fundamental security risk hasn't been eliminated.
I almost feel like the Conservative Party doesn't really care.
Yeah.
Do you not get that vibe? Because I felt like, and also these leadership elections for both parties actually are, they just do not feel very secure or very sensible. The last time they had a leadership election, I joined, should not have been able to vote in the leadership election, but still got a ballot because I joined too late.
Yeah, because you have to be a member of the party for 6 months now. Okay,
so I think it's 3 now. I was reading the thing. I may be mistaken.
Okay, but it is some months. You can't. I couldn't just join and vote in the.
Yeah, you can't join that. It's too late now, apparently. But I did the same thing. I joined as a joke. gave the Tory party £20, less of a joke. But then got a ballot in the mail and made a whole video about it where I decided to... do you remember how I voted between Hunt and Johnson?
I think you spoiled your ballot, didn't you?
I did spoil my ballot. Revolution.
I think I've still got your Tory membership card somewhere in this house.
Did I give it to you?
I somehow I ended up with it. I think I might have picked it up and popped it in my pocket and just taken it home.
As incriminating evidence for the future.
Yeah, you know,
I fully support that.
I've got a lot of contraband on you. I think
amazing. Over the years, you've just been collecting stuff that you can use to blackmail me in the future. That's very smart, actually.
True. I mean, a lot of it is published in the podcast feed.
Yeah.
which was a tactical mistake, I think. But
on my part, yeah.
I think you're also... Were you a member of the Lib Dems at the same time?
I still am a member of the Lib Dems.
Okay.
I'm also a member of the Lib Dems and therefore should not have been allowed to vote in that Tory election because you're meant to only be... a member of one party.
They have no real way of checking that, though, because
there's absolutely no. Yeah, they don't share their databases.
So yeah, it is. That whole
it's,
thing.
Yeah,
ridiculous.
It's wild to me how the idea that they would be able to go back and change their votes. I understand kind of like why initially somebody may have had that thought, but I feel like there were probably too many yes men in the process of doing that, where they were like, oh yeah, it's a long campaign, so they have until it's like the first week of September, right? The full campaign is from August to September,
right?
Where they're going around the country and doing hustings, and so the idea was you could, I don't know, submit your ballot by mail because you're really keen, and then if Rishi Sunak, for example, says, I'm going to take away all of the money from the poor places and give it back to the rich people, then you could change your vote to vote for him, which I assume is what the Conservative membership is going to do.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, it is, the whole idea of changing your vote just seems very strange. But we should probably talk a little bit about how we think the campaigns are going. I am mostly... accessing the campaign by seeing videos that people have clipped off various interviews and that sort of thing. I haven't been watching the full debates because I think they're a little bit hard work, to be honest with you. There was this
did you therefore miss Kay Burley giving the absolute smackdown of a comment to Liz Truss?
So I have seen this, but tell
my god,
about...
I loved it. For any listeners who haven't seen it, Kay Burley from Sky News, who I think is a really great journalist and a fantastic presenter, she said to Liz Truss, "You used to be a monarchy. You used to want to abolish the monarchy. Now you don't. You used to be a Lib Dem. Now you're not, etc., etc." Like loads of things that she's flip flopped on, including her most recent policy about trying to pay poor people less money. which is a gross misrepresentation of her policy, to be fair, on my part. And Kay Burley then goes, at the end of listing all of these things that she's changed her mind on, goes, "Will the real Liz Truss please stand up?"
It's so cold.
It's so good.
I mean, I suppose the thing is that it's not really... It's kind of past the point where that's a question of like, you know, you seem to change your mind a lot. What's that all about? And it is just, I mean, it's an attack, basically. She was fully dismissing her, as you say, as a flip-flopper. And people's positions change over time, but it does, and some people argue that actually there's consistency in Liz Truss's positioning, that she's, for a Conservative, she's quite liberal, so it's not that surprising that she'd have moved from the Lib Dems to the Tories. And, you know, her previous remarks about Deliveroo and Uber and Airbnbs and, you know, all the gig economy stuff and how people will be more free, and that's what the youth want.
Freedom, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, exactly.
So I feel like whenever... I haven't seen every single debate, but whenever I've seen a debate between the two of them, Rishi Sunak just comes off so much more competent, more hungry. He seems to, like, actually understand the stuff that he's proposing, whereas Lizzie Truss, my mate Lizzie, Liz Truss does not seem to really be able to answer in depth especially economic questions. However, whenever we have a YouGov poll that came out quite recently, that with polling between the 20th to the 21st of July and the 29th of July to the 2nd of August, Liz Truss's, the voting intention of Conservative Party members has actually increased. So in mid-July, she was at just under 50% of Tory Party members intended to vote for Liz Truss, with 31% intending to vote for Rishi Sunak. That in itself is a pretty damning poll, but that has increased despite what I would argue are terrible performances in debates. She's gone up to 60%. She's increased her lead, according to this YouGov poll, which are like one of the best pollsters. She's now got 60% of Tory members who are intending to vote, and only 26 are intending to vote for Rishi Sunak. What am I missing?
People like Liz Truss, I guess.
How? I said it in my fucking, in my video where I reviewed all of their leadership intention videos, where it was, she just is a terrible, terrible communicator. Like, whenever she speaks in public, she just comes across like a deer in the fucking headlights, like an animatronic AI.
I mean, maybe they don't value clear, persuasive communication very much in the Tory party. I mean, they you know, Boris Johnson, you know, was a charismatic figure, but he wasn't exactly the clearest of communicators, was he?
Mm-hmm. No.
So in that sense, they're clearly not that bothered. I mean, I think to a large degree, the Tory party, I mean, this is just obvious, but the Tory party is obsessed with Margaret Thatcher, and I think that's true of the MPs, and I think it's true.
So you reckon all of this cosplaying by Liz Truss, where she's dressed up like Margaret Thatcher going to Russia. She's dressed up like Margaret Thatcher in a tank. She recently flew to the Isle of Man. I don't know if she flew. She went to the Isle of Man, maybe on the ferry. Maybe she took the hovercraft. It's a lovely way to get there. She went over to the Isle of Man to take a photo in front of the world's largest union flag. They've just painted the side of a fucking warehouse. It's not an actual union flag. What are they bloody talking about? But replicating another iconic, like, Thatcher photo. I can't believe that they are going to vote for, if this is true, I cannot believe that they are going to vote for somebody, a derivative Margaret Thatcher, who just, it is cosplay. It is just like pandering and mimicking all of these things. Who is Liz Truss? In the words of Kay Burley, will the real Liz Truss please stand up?
I mean, I think she does really believe in a lot of this free market stuff. So, I mean, she clearly has just changed her positions for political advantage, like the Brexit one being the most famous one, where she started off as an ardent Remainer.
Well, she was a Remainer during the for the referendum, and then switched.
And then she switched and became a very zealous Brexiteer. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's that uncommon for, I mean, it's very common for aspiring leaders of political parties to try and touch the same cues as previous leaders, to sort of say, I'm the true successor to, you know, this person or that person. So a lot of this stuff isn't that surprising, but you know, if I mean, actually your dad used to be in the Conservative Party, right? So you might actually,
yeah, he was a councillor.
Yeah, so I realize a bit of time has passed, but was your impression of what he said of his like local party members, were they particularly,
oh, he hated them.
But were they particularly Thatcherite, or were they, you know, more normal than that?
I honestly wouldn't be able to tell you. I was too young. I don't really have very many memories of it, but I do know from talking about it. I don't have direct memories of it, but having spoken to him about it in subsequent years, I know he absolutely hated all of them, because my dad isn't an ideologue. Like, he likes the idea of lower taxes and like friendly business and like those headline things that sometimes define conservatives. But he used to, I can't believe I'm telling my dad's like conservative counselor story, but here we go. Sorry, Dad. Where he he'd be sitting on the council and he'd get told off because he voted with the Lib Dems and Labour because he thought their ideas were better. And he'd get told off by their whip.
And he was like, they were like, you can't do that. You're in the opposing, but we're meant to oppose them. And he was like, well, it's a good idea. So that's how effective my family have traditionally been in the realms of politics, and probably why I should never go in, because I think I'd be quite similar.
I've got a lot of time for that. I guess you could argue it is a betrayal of, you know, local voters or whatever, but...
100%. And the only reason that he ever joined was so that he could get the extension to our house approved. So there you go.
That's a lot of effort for an extension.
It is.
But, I mean, if you... Conversely, I mean, you said there were a lot of ideologues in your dad's local party. Matthew Paris, who's a former Tory MP, but is now very estranged from the party, he used to talk about going to meetups with his local constituency party. And he would say a lot of them weren't that ideological. It was just like publicly minded people, basically, who you know, wanted to have some involvement in politics, but it wasn't like they were.
Well, then I wanted to talk about this as well. Then where does this tack to the culture wars right that Rishi Sunak is desperately making? Where does that come from if the rest of the party is not full of ideologues? He's talked about ripping up parts of the Equality Act from 2010 that stops people from being able to discriminate.
Which parts is he trying to change?
I'm not sure very deeply.
Okay, but he's trying to change some of that.
Yeah, he's like been slamming the Equality Act, and the Equality Act essentially means that he made it illegal to discriminate against somebody based on their sex, gender, race, gender reassignment,
religion,
as well. Yeah, all of those kinds of things. Watch him not change the religion clause. And also start talking about kind of like woke stuff. He's waded into a little bit of the trans debate. The idea that this is what the conservative base want, it must be coming from somewhere.
Yeah, it must be. Yeah, I just...
Because he's so desperate, because he's only on... In these YouGov polls, despite his, what I think objectively is a better performance, he's only on about 30%. Of people backing him, he's still doing this massive clamber saying that he actually is going to cut taxes in 7 years and all of those kinds of things.
Because initially he wasn't going to cut taxes until the economy had improved.
The red line, the defining line between them, was Liz Truss was going to make immediate tax cuts and Rishi Sunak was not. Rishi Sunak because he wanted to get inflation under control, and Liz Truss because she doesn't understand economics.
So, a couple of like broader questions. Somebody was saying on Twitter the other day that at some point one of the major parties, I assume he meant Labour or the Tories, is going to reverse the decision to allow normal members to vote on who becomes leader and revert to a system whereby the MPs choose who becomes leader. I personally find that exceedingly
well, that's
unlikely.
A relatively new thing. It is, right? It going to the membership, for the final two going to the membership.
It is relatively new. I just can't, as many people have pointed out, it's one of the few tangible benefits of being a member of one of the major parties is
you get to go to the local Conservative club, I assume.
Yes. I don't think most people, from what they can tell, pay their fees and don't really engage with the party much beyond that. I mean, when I was a member of the Lib Dems, that described me basically for the most part.
Yeah, we tried to go to one thing and it was a bit weird, and then we never went again, did we?
Yeah, Lynn Featherstone was
Lynn
there.
Featherstone was there. Yeah, she was lovely.
Yeah, she was very, she was
But
very
then
funny.
Did write a book about how she made gay marriage happen, which pretty much erased several decades of campaigning by LGBTQ+ people. Anyway, I'm not bitter.
Yeah. The second question I'm kind of interested in, I mean, at this point, it just looks inevitable that Liz Truss is going to win based on the polling, and that the gap is significant enough that I think we can be reasonably confident about
that. Yeah, that big of a gap, even with dodgy polling, which YouGov generally, YouGov is a good pollster, that bigger gap is probably going to be right.
I'd have thought so. And, I mean, absent some scandal that somehow disqualifies her from, from continuing any further. But as you said, what sort of scandal could it be, given that this Rishi Sunak video came out with him talking about defunding deprived areas? It would have to be something quite big. Once like Liz Truss is in office, assuming it's her or even Rishi Sunak, the economic crisis, which we referenced in the introduction, is going to become so acute, right? I mean, particularly by this autumn, and you've got like the prospect of huge.
They're saying going into recession before Christmas, and then it lasting for basically until the next election is what the Bank of England suggested, right? 18 months, they said.
Yeah, that might, you know, that sounds right. But I mean, inflation's going to hit 13%. They previously said it was going to be 11%. I think it was. I'm not sure when it's projected to do that. It might be November. And also, you've got the gas bills and other, you know, the costs of food is going up in supermarkets as well. All of these different factors. It's good. I mean, in many ways, you can understand why a guy like Ben Wallace pulled out of, or, you know, announced he wasn't going to run, despite being an early favourite.
Ben Wallace, who was defence secretary,
is still defence secretary
and was the most popular member of the, well, MP and member of the cabinet among Conservative Party members.
Yeah, that's right.
According to Conservative Home, to be fair, which but, is, they don't, they're not a proper pollster, but they did a straw poll.
Right. But who, you know, who would want this job? Like, it, I just can't see it going anywhere but really badly for them. Like,
right. I 100% agree. But these people, Jimmy, clearly do not have a foot in reality and think that they are going to be able to solve everything. Liz Truss is going around saying, well, no, both of them are going around saying that a recession is not inevitable. And I'm like, you are not king of the world, my dear friends. Sometimes you do not have the power you think you do.
I mean, I suppose what advantage the Tories do have at the moment is they still do have a substantial majority in Parliament. If they were willing to take radical action to change things, they could do so. But, I mean, it's not like that would be plausible if they were a bunch of, like, Jeremy Corbyn-esque state interventionist types. But, as we've said, they're not. So the inclination they're going to have is to sit back and let rip as far as, you know, as far as they can get away with. But yeah, so just one light question before we move on to monkeypox, and you can tell people about your dreadful experience trying to obtain it. Do you think it would be a good idea for whoever wins this contest to call a snap election quickly, so potentially before the end of the year,
or do you so that they avoid maybe?
Or do you think it'd be better for them to wait until 2024 when...
I just feel like a 2024, from all of the predictions that we have from experts, and I'm so sorry, everybody, but I do think that generally experts know what they're talking about. I feel like calling a snap election as quickly as possible, maybe another... Oh, can you imagine another winter election?
I mean, it'd be fine, I think, from my point of view, but...
Oh, no, it's so miserable.
Is it that much? I mean, you're not going to be leafleting for them, are you? Or for the Lib Dems?
I actually might.
You might?
I might volunteer my time in, like, some West Country seats and really ham up my Bristolian accent.
Okay.
You know, like, proper help out, something like that.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, I would go... Were I, heaven forbid, Liz Truss or Rishi Sunak? God, can you imagine? If I'm ever in that scenario, have me assassinated, Jimmy, because the country does not deserve that. I would probably get the job and then go for an early election as soon as possible. Because it's only going to get worse.
That's my logic, is that I just think you can either have
No one seems to be suggesting that, though. No one seems to be asking them that on the campaign trail.
I've not read anything that has suggested they are asking them that. But, I mean, I guess maybe Tory members don't particularly care whether they'd go for an election sooner or later. But the general public would care, obviously.
I think that the Conservatives want to stay in power. That's the only ideology apart from Thatcherism they seem to have. Although they are still voting for Liz Truss, apparently, so shows how much they know.
Okay. Should we lighten the mood?
I'd love to talk
instead
about the pandemic ripping its way through my community. So
it's not a pandemic yet, is it?
Technically a pandemic, but it is.
I don't think it's endemic.
High concern or something.
Yeah, it's a public safety crisis.
Wait, hold on. What has the WHO said? Monkeypox. Fill the time briefly. Tell them what a monkey is.
So I guess monkeypox must have some connection to monkeys, unless it's just one of those names that is completely erroneous and is, if anything, defaming the monkey community.
Great. I can't find what the WHO actually said about it. Monkeypox, as we'd said in the intro, is an endemic disease in certain animal populations, generally in West Africa. It often jumps into human populations, but generally doesn't spread very far beyond then. Very rarely leaves West Africa. It is a cousin of smallpox, but does not, for which we have managed to eradicate, but does not transmit nearly as easily and is not nearly as deadly as smallpox is. It is still apparently fucking painful and has killed several people where they already have underlying conditions.
You mean it's killed people in the UK, or
it's killed people in Spain and somewhere else, and some people in, I believe, in West Africa as well. But the numbers are still very, very low, but the case numbers are high. Mm. It basically creates a rash, similar to chickenpox.
Yeah, so you get sores all over your body, including.
Yes, and then through contact with those sores, through breathing.
Breathing is a very rare sort of.
It's very rare, but it is technically possible. But it's mainly through physical contact. That's how it spreads. It's not like a COVID, and it's never going to spread at the same kind of rate as COVID. The problem is, and so for the vast majority of people, monkeypox is not going to be something that they need to worry a huge amount about. At least not yet. The bad thing about monkeypox is that it has entered into a population that often expose themselves to close quarters more frequently, shall we say, than others. And that is men who have sex with men. Men who have sex with men, especially in built-up urban areas, I think I can speak generally here, tend to have more sexual partners, tend to maybe be in situations where they are rubbing up against one another a little bit more. Think of a club, let alone a sex club. And it's gotten into those populations, and well over 90% of cases, at least in the UK, and I think outside of West Africa, have been within men who have sex with men populations. Gay men, bi men, trans women have also been identified if they have sex with men who have sex with men. Trans women have also been included here. I'm a little bit worried about it. Like, I know it's probably not going to kill me, but apparently it is a fucking horrible disease. It's really, really painful. Basically, you have to be off your tits on codeine for 3 weeks, and you have to isolate for a long time.
So you generally recover 2 to 4 weeks, I was reading.
Yeah, exactly.
But you can be scarred by the marks.
Like chicken pox. Yeah, exactly. So there has been... Now I can only speak for what's happening in the UK. We've had our first cases of monkeypox, confirmed cases of monkeypox in the UK around mid-May, and now we're in the thousands, the vast majority of which are in London. I am a gay man in London. I sometimes go to gay venues. I don't have a huge amount of sex, but I sometimes enjoy sex. I'm not the highest risk group. Those of whom are those who have lots of anonymous sex and multiple sex partners. I don't really do that very much. Or people who are sex workers. And although the temptation of OnlyFans is always beckoning, I have never partaken in sex work. So I'm in the at-risk group, but I'm not in the most at-risk of the groups. It would be still nice to be vaccinated against it, because once you get the full dose of the monkeypox vaccine, we're actually using the smallpox vaccine in order to be able to immunize the population. You get an 85% defense against monkeypox. That sounds like a pretty good deal.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
It is next to fucking impossible to get a vaccine in London at the moment. They initially were rolling it out to those particularly high-risk groups, sex workers, and those with high volumes of sexual anonymous sexual partners. But they were also doing walk-ins a couple of weeks ago. Most of which have been happening at Guy's and St. Thomas's Hospital, which is at London Bridge. The first day where they did walk-in vaccinations for monkeypox, there were hours and hours of waits. The waits were hours and hours long, and there were queues around the block of men who have sex with men trying to get this vaccine. People were joking that if the general population had the attitude that gay men had towards vaccinations, COVID would be done, over, sorted, never have to worry about it anymore. Wouldn't that have been nice? Guys have stopped people from have stopped doing walking vaccinations on weekends because they are so overwhelmed.
You're talking about the hospital rather the hospital. Than guys in general.
No, not guys in general. Capital G guys. There's no ability to book yourself a vaccine. They are now going through and reaching out to people that they, and this is sexual health and gum clinics, are reaching out themselves to people who historically have had multiple sexual partners or have been treated for other STIs in recent times. That makes sense to me, but it also means that I can't get a monkeypox vaccine, and it makes me really nervous to be in like queer spaces, and I like being in queer spaces because it's not an STI. It's not like stop having sex then. It's a vaccine. It's a disease that is by close proximity, and that could be a club, that could be playing sport, it could be sleeping in the same bed as somebody who has it, using the same towel as somebody, like all of those physical kind of like touch points. There really doesn't seem to be very much of a public response to this from the UK government. It seems to all be done by local NHS trusts, local sexual health and gum clinics. And most of it, the way that I'm finding out about monkeypox vaccines and where you can get them, it's all on Twitter and WhatsApp groups. And I'm very frustrated that this is how we are approaching sexual health in this country. Well, not sexual health, public health in general in this country, because it's currently in my population. And there have been a handful of cases outside of men who have sex with men. But it's really worrying that we may end up it may end up breaking into children, for example. Have you ever been to a creche? You see children rolling all over one another. That's why chickenpox spreads so fervently in those spaces. Can you imagine if it gets into there and then spreads through the population there? This needs to be nipped in the bud. There needs to be more of a like a better coordinated rollout of monkeypox vaccines.
So you think the government...
Shall we move on to Taiwan now? I feel like I've said everything.
So what do you think the government should be doing? Just allocating more funding, just generally putting more effort into communications, just generally doing more, is that what?
100%, but don't make that HIV advert again. Nobody wants that, thank you.
HIV advert are you talking about?
The one where it's a tombstone. Have you not seen that? Is that a thing that only queer people know?
I'm not familiar with the advert.
No, it's like a really famous kind of like HIV. It was an advert on British television, I think in the early 90s, that told you to stop having sex, essentially.
Well, you know, it seems reasonable advice, as it goes.
I'll punch you.
But, you know, even though you think it's a problem, you think the government should be doing more about it, it's unlikely that this is going to develop into a crisis in the same way that COVID was a crisis, right?
We're not going to have lockdowns.
No.
I don't think that we should be... I think we've learned I would have hoped that we would have learned that allowing a disease to go through a population, no matter how specific and small, is not a very good way of being able to defend the wider population of a country against as part of kind of like a public health measure. We don't know how is this strain of monkeypox going to mutate. Is it going to become more virulent or more severe? We really should be taking as many steps as possible. I have heard whispers and rumors, I don't know how much truth there is in this, that governments are choosing not to release the smallpox vaccine, which is used to defend against monkeypox, because it's under lock and key for bioterrorism reasons, because there's fears that monkeypox would be used as a bioweapon. But we need it now, because it shouldn't be.
So they're holding back some vaccines in case monkeypox is used as a bioweapon. Is that what you're saying?
It's what I have heard.
That's what the rumor is.
That is a rumor, and it's as truthful as the resources permit.
I mean, it doesn't suggest that we've learned a great deal from the pandemic experience, that the government does seem to be slowballing this particular thing.
Also, nobody seems like they're in charge at the moment. Who's the health secretary? I can't remember.
Stephen Barclay.
Oh, great. Say something about monkeys again so I can see if he's actually said a public statement.
I think I've used up all my monkey related material, I'm afraid. I do think, on a semi-serious point, it's slightly harder to take a disease seriously when it's called monkeypox.
Well, the WHO were going to change it. So remember how we were calling COVID coronavirus? And that's confusing because coronavirus is like everything from the common cold to COVID. They were talking about renaming monkeypox because it's a fucking stupid name.
It is a bit of a silly name. But I mean, it is memorable, I guess, which is an advantage. I feel like we had this argument ages ago, but it was somewhat easier to remember the different strains of COVID when they were actually named after places rather than the Greek alphabet system that they moved to. Once a name is stuck, it's pretty hard to change it. But monkeypox does. I mean, I suppose even chickenpox sounds silly. So maybe just stop naming things after animals would be my advice. Have you figured out whether Stephen Barclay has said anything about...
It doesn't look like. All I'm seeing is loads of letters that people have written to him, which suggests there hasn't been a huge response.
Yeah, so there's this open letter from various people, but the Terence Higgins Foundation is one of the signatories, and there's some MPs, I think, have also signed it, including somebody from Labour and somebody from the Tories. Mm. So there are people calling for the government to do more.
And let me add my voice.
So the right dishonourable has also added its, signature.
Considerable clout, yeah.
Massive clout. Should we talk about Taiwan then?
Yeah, go on. I want to avoid this being another monologue. Very conscious. What do you understand about it as somebody who maybe isn't as intimately concerns?
Well, I don't know anyone who lives in Taiwan, so I think I'm much more removed from it than you are. I mean, it's essentially I think most of our listeners will know the background to this, but Taiwan exists as a kind of independent country because the nationalists ended up fleeing to there during the Chinese Civil War, which was after World War II. And mainland China considers that Taiwan is rightfully part of its territory. So the assumption is that as China becomes more powerful, it will be more tempted to try and take control of Taiwan. And the great fear is that that will end up in an invasion of some sort or military action.
Mm-hmm. And it currently exists in a weird limbo state of one China. So saying that China exists... there is only one China that can be recognized internationally because previously Taiwan, what we now call Taiwan, was seen as the government in exile of China, and so Taiwan was still representing China abroad, despite the fact that it was only in Taiwan. And so it respects that there is only one China, and that seat of China is Beijing. Like, whoever is in power in Beijing represents China. But the two systems, the respect of the two systems. So that means that... like Taiwan is able to, like, currently at least, able to govern its own affairs without kind of without interference.
Well, in most ways it is an independent country, right? It functions as an independent country,
kind of,
but...
and it has observer status in a lot of international institutions as well.
Yeah, so I mean, famously, I think this is right, it can't be represented at the Olympics as Taiwan, I don't think.
I mean, it technically could. They had a referendum about this a few years ago where they were like, should we just call ourselves Taiwan? But they have to call themselves, or they have the Olympic Committee of Taiwan have chosen to call themselves Chinese Taipei, open right. brackets, Republic of China, close brackets.
Right, because Republic of China is the proper name for
it's
Taiwan.
It's the proper, yeah, the grown-up, yeah. You've been a naughty boy name of Taiwan.
Yeah, yeah. But... I mean, in practice, its defense policy is heavily tied up with the United States foreign policy. The US, in some ways, guarantees Taiwan's independence. But the question now is, will they do so if push comes to shove? So Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, went over there, I suppose, as a demonstration of US commitment to Taiwan and to Taiwanese independence. And initially the idea was floated and there was a huge pushback from China. And I think from what I was reading, it became kind of necessary for Nancy Pelosi to follow through on the promise of a visit. Otherwise it would have looked humiliating from America's point of
view. Yeah, it kept on getting pushed back because she got COVID and stuff. And also she's very old.
She's older than 80, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. We could Google this, but she's very old. I mean, this seems like it's going to be a feature of geopolitics for the next 10 years, is China and the US doing a tug of war over Taiwan's position. As I said in the intro, the Chinese, as well as like protesting this in terms of speeches and the newspapers that they control, writing rude things about the Americans, they also organise various military exercises around the Taiwanese Strait and around Taiwan. I read one description referred to it as China putting a ring of steel around Taiwan. So they kind of encircled the island at some point.
It does quite terrifyingly show what they could do.
Well, I think...
There were suggestions that they were going to literally fire rockets over Taiwan. And I don't think they've ended up doing that. But they're just basically swinging their dicks around.
So I think it is an interesting question of whether... how committed is America to Taiwan? Like, if it came down to it, you know, America is a nuclear power, China is a nuclear power. If the Chinese one day decided to invade Taiwan... what would the Americans do? I mean, obviously they would condemn it, but would they actually physically fight back?
So all of this is tied up with a very similar... How similar is it? It gets called similar to the agreement from the mid-90s that disarmed Ukraine. But then... So basically NATO and... Russia, in order to disarm Ukraine of all of its nuclear weapons that it inherited from the Soviet Union, they signed a memorandum of understanding, I believe, to respect the integrity of Ukraine's borders. There is something similar regarding, and obviously that's all gone tits up, surprise. Yeah. There is something similar from the 1970s. So basically, when the US switched its recognition of where China was, like politically, to Beijing and therefore the Chinese Communist Party, there was a huge amount of concern from the government in exile in Taiwan, who then lobbied like the American political system, to then create this act, which is the Taiwan Relations Act, that basically says that the US is going to defend Taiwan if China ever tries anything funny. It doesn't recognize, actually, the terminology of Republic of China. It calls it governing authorities on Taiwan, which is really interesting. Like, how will you end up defining that? Because also the political split in Taiwan tends to be shush, let's ignore the fact that we actually think we're China, to the people who are like, we are Taiwanese, we are Taiwan. It's the DBP and the KMT.
So what, in terms of general public opinion, what's the split between those two views? Is it quite even, or...?
I don't know the splits. I haven't got polling up. But it tends to be more pro. Well, it's more pro DPP at the moment, who are the we are Taiwan. We are kind of like the long term goal is to be recognised as an independent state, but we also don't want to rock the boat too much. What was really so for me when Nancy Pelosi landed. Taiwanese media went like bananas. It was like midnight in Taiwan, and there were like all of these live streams. Everybody was watching all of the live streams of her car driving from the airport to her hotel. A load of people turned up at her hotel. Taiwanese media is also absolutely fucking bananas, where they just kept on dropping like really weird facts, like she has been flying for 13 hours and 27 minutes and 18 seconds, and her favorite meal from Taiwan is chocolate boba, and like just absolutely crazy shit that you only really see in Taiwan. I was watching all of that and was just like really worried, because I was like, is China now going to invade? Great. Really terrified.
I mean, presumably China wouldn't invade while Nancy Pelosi was actually there.
No, but it made me really anxious to see. Oh no, like, part of me is like, Taiwan thrives. I have the impression that Taiwan thrives when nobody is thinking about it. And so I initially had a really scary thing where I was like, oh no, Taiwan is going to be like at the forefront. China is going to be wanting to swing a stick around and jeopardize the safety of people in Taiwan. Since then, Tsai Ing-wen, the president, has had a chance to globally state her case. People now know who she is, and has been able to kind of like really make the case for Taiwan to not be fucked over by China. A lot of the democracy versus not democracy rhetoric, I think, has worked. Although, interestingly, in 1979, when the Defense of Taiwan, the Taiwan Relations Act was signed, Taiwan was not a democracy. It was under military dictatorship. And so, I think actually in the long term, what Nancy Pelosi has done has made it more difficult for China to be bullish on Taiwan. A lot of links have been drawn between what's happening in Taiwan and Ukraine, because it's kind of like
I think they're very, like very analogous. You know, you've got
it's a massive superpower that claims the territory of a state that has broken away from it in the past, yeah. But has its unique kind of like identity.
Yes.
I think those comparisons are fair, but I think Ukraine not going well for Russia has really slowed down, made it less likely that Xi Jinping is going to make any kind of a move anytime soon. This is also a really interesting point of Chinese. For Chinese politics, because Xi Jinping going into the autumn is about to go into the and decide whether or not he's going to get a third term as the president.
I thought did he previously change the constitution to allow him more time as president? Was that about term limits or something?
Yeah, does that remind you of somebody else? Putin. Sorry.
I think Donald Trump actually had some sort of wheeze to change the constitution to reduce the 2-term limit in America. Sorry, to eliminate it. It's a very common move. I have a feeling that Erdogan in Turkey did something similar as well. So it's...
I love that for us. Yeah. But yeah, I am still worried about Taiwan. I actually think now that all of this has happened, even though there's been a lot of, like I said, dick swinging by the Chinese, I think that violence on Taiwan has become less likely since Pelosi's arrival and then exit. But it still makes me nervous.
See, I think the problem, and I was reading an Atlantic article which defined this really well, is that previously the Chinese Communist Party has established its legitimacy by telling the Chinese, we're going to make you richer, which you know, has allowed it to do all the market-led reforms and that sort of thing. And the writer of this Atlantic piece was suggesting that the Communist Party is now more, I suppose it's ideological in a way, but it's more motivated by great power status, really. And it's becoming more a case that they want to tell the Chinese people, we're going, you know, you're going to support us because we're going to make China great and respected again. And there's a lot of stuff in Chinese political rhetoric about humiliation by the European empires.
Oh yeah. And I mean, we did the Opium Wars is kind of like cited as the low point.
Yeah.
And things like the 99-year lease of Hong Kong are very symbolic for people like Xi Jinping, the president, that are kind of like representative of the low point of China.
Yeah. And I mean, to me, it's hard to tell, like with diplomatic events like this, whether it makes Taiwan safer or less safe in the short term. But I think in the long term, it's just going to become more and more difficult for Taiwan to maintain independence because China is going to continue to grow richer. It's continuing to invest in its military in all sorts of ways. Mm. America is, relative to China, is going to become poorer. It's going to be less military. It's going to have less military overmatch, I suppose. You know, its military advantages are going to recede as China invests more in its military. I think this is a very hard thing to sustain over the long term, and the only real hope is that, you know, by the time China is powerful enough that it could conceivably take Taiwan, I mean, some people say they're already there, but that it will no longer want to. And given the political structures in China, that seems exceedingly unlikely to me at the moment.
China, however, is in a very interesting, I think you are right, but I think the can has been significantly kicked a little bit down the road, if not because of the domestic problems that China is having. There's huge problems with there's a lot of civil unrest in China at the moment because of dodgy loans that have been that are now, like the dodgy loans that were given out are now coming home to roost, kind of like cost inflation and cost of living crisis and stuff like that. A lot of similar things that we're dealing with internationally as well. But there's, yeah, a lot of discontent in China at the moment. And so the willingness to support a war by the people wouldn't necessarily... I don't know. No, probably they would support it because all Chinese people think that Taiwan is China, at least as far as I know.
Oh, that's what the Chinese government wants you to believe.
Yeah, that's fair. And I haven't been in China for a very long time, so what do I know?
The comparison is quite funny, though, because the amount of like British people that basically thinks it's illegitimate for Britain to still have sovereignty over the Falklands is kind of hilarious. Like, for most people, it's just a case of look at the map. Well, the Falklands is much closer to Argentina than it is to us, so clearly, you know, clearly it belongs to the Argentines. But
there's people who live there.
Oh yeah, I don't support Britain. I don't support that argument at all. I think it's nonsense. But it is a very
the parallel there is like the thing whenever it comes to these kinds of situations. My North Star is always people should be able to decide who governs them.
Yeah.
I don't really care about like historic claims to land or whatever. I think that's a load of bullshit. If you can't convince people that you should be that this system or these people should be the people running the shop, then fuck you. You deserve to be chucked out like Sri Lanka. On that cheerful note.
Yes, should we wrap this up?
Yes, I think so. You can find me on all social media platforms at Jazza John, and Jimmy is online.
On Twitter, at JDE Nichols.
JDE Nichols.
Or you can go to my Substack, if you're not already, which is jdenichols.substack.com.
Yeah, it's fine.
It's fine.
Join our Patreon.
It's still worth watching Jazza's YouTube video of all of the different Tory video campaigns, Tory leadership video campaigns. It's still very entertaining, even now we've whittled down the candidates. So it is half an hour, though. So,
It is, yeah. No, yeah. Sit down, have a cup of tea.
Yeah.
All right. Toodaloo.
Bye-bye.